Well met, and welcome to episode 11, the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for September 13th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and as you've probably figured out, there wasn't a podcast last week. You see, I'm a college football fan, and last week was the beginning of the season, so my schedule got a little consumed by all things Bruin rather than all things Bard. Sorry, guy's gotta have his priorities. And I'm even repurposing a little content and recording this podcast a little early this week, as the family and I will be weekending in Knoxville, Tennessee, where my UCLA football team will take on the Vols. But I digress. This week's podcast is going to be a long one, to make up for last week's dearth. This week we're going to go through a brief introduction of the play, a not-so-brief plot synopsis, a discussion of the induction, which will force some talk about the play's versions, and a new weekly segment in which we'll talk about the past week's blog entries. But first, let's give away a t-shirt. It's contest time again. Okay, so you're a director, and you're about to mount a production of The Taming of the Shrew, or it could be a movie version. Who would be your dream cast? Why? The winner, the one with the most interesting and most well-thought-out and presented cast, will win a Bill/Shakespeare Project t-shirt. Enter by commenting to the blog entry for this podcast at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Now, contest entries are due before 12 noon Pacific on Thursday, September 24th. I'll announce the winner on the last podcast of the month, Sunday, September 27th. Good luck. Okay, let us begin. The Taming of the Shrew. Here we have a popular play with a hilarious battle of the sexes, but its troglodytic view of male superiorities tends to make modern audiences cringe while flat out enraging the feminists in the crowd. The concept that any woman could be tamed is bad enough, that any should be tamed even worse, and all of this makes the play controversial and makes any production a risky proposition. So let's take a look at this difficult play. The Taming of the Shrew begins with a false start, as the play as we know it, or at least as we think we know it, is actually a play within a play, kinda. In the toothed scene Induction, Christopher Sly is introduced, shown to be a drunk and one who doesn't pay for his drinks to boot, and promptly passes out in the street. He's found by an unnamed lord who thinks it would be a great practical joke to take the unconscious Sly, set him up in the lord's own manor, and see what happens when he wakes up not as Christopher Sly, but as a wealthy lord. Some wackiness ensues as Sly does wake, does begin to think himself a rich man, and does begin to watch a play. This play. In Act 1, Scene 1 proper, young Lucentio and his manservant Tranio enter Padua. Lucentio has come to do his father Vincentio's business, but Tranio cautions him to make sure that he doesn't succumb to the whole all work and no play syndrome. And this advice is no sooner out of his mouth than Lucentio spies a beautiful young woman, Bianca Minola. But with beauty comes problems. The first problem is that there are other suitors for Bianca. The second and larger problem for both Lucentio and those other suitors is Bianca's elder sister Katharina, who is too rough and cursed and shrewd. And the problem is that the father Baptista has declared that there will be no vying for Bianca's hand until Kate is wed. And while no one on the scene is willing to take on Kate, they are willing to take on the only contact Baptista will allow Bianca, music and poetry study. So Lucentio has a plan. Lucentio will disguise himself as a schoolmaster and insert himself into the Minola household. But who will do Lucentio's work if Lucentio is acting the schoolmaster? The servant Tranio, who will assume the role of Lucentio, and Lucentio's page Biondello will take on the role of the manservant. As this scene ends, we are back to the Christopher Sly story. As he wakes up, he wishes that the play twere done, and for Sly it pretty much is, because we never see or hear from him again in the play. Now, Act 2, Scene 2 begins with the entrance of Petruchio and his servant Grumio, fresh from Verona. Notice Petruchio, not Petruchio. Who knew? Guess that's what happens when you get your Shakespearean background from moonlighting, huh? Anyway, Petruchio has come to Padua as part of his voyage to see the world following the death of his father and to wive it wealthily in Padua. Petruchio runs into an old friend, Hortensio, who just happens to be one of Bianca's suitors from the first scene. Hortensio reluctantly tells Petruchio about Kate, reluctantly because friends don't let friends marry shrews, and as the Minolas are rich, Petruchio is ready for the wooing to begin. But before this can start, they spy Gremio, the other Bianca suitor from the earlier scene, with a schoolmaster, Cambio, who just happens to be Lucentio in disguise. Now, you keeping up with this so far? Grumio is Petruchio's servant. Gremio is a suitor to Bianca. Hortensio is also a suitor to Bianca. Lucentio is also a suitor to Bianca, but he's going by the name of Cambio so he can slip into Bianca's life as her tutor. And Lucentio is actually Tranio, the manservant of the real Lucentio. Got it? Good, because there's going to be a quiz later. Now, Act 2 of The Taming of the Shrew is a single scene, and it begins with an entrance by Kate and Bianca, except something is amiss. The stage directions tell us that Bianca enters with her hands tied. Kate attempts to interrogate Bianca on her choice of suitors, but Bianca has not yet made her choice. When their father Baptista arrives, Kate even strikes Bianca. The sisters leave, and then Baptista is deluged with suitors. Gremio with Lucentio / Cambio, the schoolmaster, Petruchio with Hortensio, now disguised as a schoolmaster himself, and Tranio / Lucentio with Biondello, who bears books and a lute, but thankfully is not disguising himself as a schoolmaster. Petruchio introduces himself to Baptista. "Pray, have you a daughter called Caterina, fair and virtuous?" To which Baptista responds, "I have a daughter, sir, called Caterina." You can almost hear the rim shot. Now, Petruchio states his objective of wooing Kate, and as a sign of good faith, he introduces Hortensio as Licio, the tutor. Baptista welcomes all, and then sends Hortensio / Licio, Lucentio / Cambio, and Biondello off to meet with Kate, leaving Petruchio to discuss all matters marital with Baptista, including parental dowry and spousal assurances. Their discussions are interrupted by the re-entrance of Hortensio Licio with his head broke, as Kate has hit him over the head with the lute. Baptista takes all the suitors with him and takes them this time to Bianca and leaves Petruchio to wait for Kate's entrance. And then they meet. It's a battle of words, of wits, of hits and fits and starts. And by the time Baptista returns, Petruchio announces their plans to marry the following Sunday. This scene and dialogue is one that we will investigate more closely later this month at the blog, but to suffice it to say, it's classic. When Kate argues and denies this, Petruchio tells her father that it is her and his agreement that she'll still be shrewish in public, though loving in private. And he heads off to Venice to buy apparel for the wedding day. And for once, Kate is shocked into submissive silence. Baptista, thrilled, is now ready to marry off Bianca as well, a week later. You see, things move quickly in the Minola household, as fast as they do at the Capulets. He has narrowed his suitors down to Gremio and Tranio / Lucentio, who then bid for her love. Tranio Lucentio wins, but only if he can bring proof and approval from his father Vincentio. Without it, Gremio wins Bianca, so Tranio now ponders the invention of a father to fool Baptista. Act 3, Scene 1 takes place a day before Petruchio and Kate's nuptials. In the Minola household, we find the two faux schoolmasters, Lucentio, disguised as Cambio, and Hortensio, disguised as Licio, tutoring Bianca. Here we find that though Bianca may be the more pursued of the sisters, Kate doesn't have any monopoly on forwardness. Bianca is in charge and leaves no doubt about it. She allows Lucentio Cambio to tutor her in Latin while Hortensio Licio spends much of the scene tuning his lute and biding his time, to comic effect. Now through the lesson, in which Cambio reveals his true identity and purpose, we see that Bianca is falling in love with him as well. When his lesson is done, Hortensio Licio also attempts to plead his case through his lesson, but things don't go as well for him, however, as Bianca tells him, "Tut, I like it not." Act 3, Scene 2 brings us to Sunday, the wedding day, and Petruchio is late for his own nuptials. Kate, Natch, is unhappy and exits crying, and her father is sympathetic. Biondello arrives, almost in reporter mode, and gives an account of Petruchio's approach. He is dressed as poorly and outrageously as possible and riding a horse that looks as if it's on its last legs. Her father and Tranio / Lucentio are appalled, but Petruchio will have none of it. "To me she's married, not into my clothes." and he leaves to the church off stage. At this point, Tranio, Lucentio, and Lucentio Cambio are left alone on stage to discuss their daddy issues. Remember, they've got to find a man to play Vincenzo, Lucentio's father, in order to seal the deal for Bianca's hand. Then Gremio returns to recount the details of the wedding itself. Petruchio swears during the ceremony, knocks down the priest, calls for a drink, downs it at the altar, and ends the kiss with such a clamorous smack that at the parting, all the church did echo. Petruchio brings Kate and the wedding party on stage and calls for the celebration to begin, though neither he nor she will participate. He intends to take her back to his country home. The guests are stunned. Kate is angry. She even attempts to take control of the situation, but Petruchio carries her off, leaving the wedding guests and Act 3 in his wake. Act 4, Scene 1 begins at Petruchio's country estate, and the newlyweds arrive. Petruchio strikes his servants, strikes another after he drops the dinner water, throws out the meal because it's burned, then takes her to her chamber where he throws out the linens. Petruchio's self-proclaimed reign of terror has begun. She hasn't eaten, nor will she. She hasn't slept, nor will she. He's fighting a war of attrition. He's quite proud of his plan as he dares the audience, "He that knows better how to tame a shrew, let him speak." And with no response, he grants that 'tis charity to show. His charity to show us how to do it. The second scene returns us to the Minola household, where Hortensio Licio is so despondent that he reveals to Tranio Lucentio his disguise and gives up the chase, saying that he will turn his attentions to a wealthy widow. Once Hortensio leaves, enter Biondello, who has found a candidate for the role of Vincentio, a pedant, a real schoolmaster tutor. Ironic, huh? Tranio convinces the pedant to take on the role, especially since he scares the old man by telling him that anyone from the pedant city of Mantua can be condemned to death in their town of Padua. If this sounds at all familiar, then you were here 2 months ago for the Comedy of Errors. Act 3, Scene 4 begins with Kate begging Grumio for food. Grumio continues Petruchio's methods and refuses. Then enter Petruchio and his newly arrived friend Hortensio. Hortensio gets to eat while Petruchio regales Kate with a plan to attend her sister's wedding. He brings in the hatmaker and the dressmaker, then rails on them for delivering subpar goods. Subpar for Petruchio, of course, but not for Kate. The new clothes are tossed out, and the newlyweds will go back to Padua in garments poor. By the end of the scene, Petruchio is no longer satisfied with mere thanks. He now demands her total agreement. The fourth scene of the fourth act has Tranio Licentio presenting the pedant off as their father, Vincenzo, to Baptista, and it all goes well. The fifth and final scene of Act 4 finds Petruchio and Kate, with Hortensio and servants, on the road to Padua. Petruchio is winning his war of wills with Kate. He now has her agreeing with him that the sun is the moon and vice versa. Enter an old man, who Petruchio instructs Kate to greet as a young woman. And she does. The taming is seemingly complete. And that would be enough, seemingly, for the scene as well. But this being Shakespeare, and Shakespeare being Shakespeare, no disguise is worth anything if there's neither confusion nor wackiness to ensue, and thus we learn the old man's identity. It's the real Vincentio, on his way to Padua to surprise his son, Lucentio. Well, fancy that. Kate and Petruchio are on their way to Padua for Kate's sister's wedding to Lucentio. Now, Act 5, Scene 1 of The Taming of the Shrew depicts the much wackiness that ensues. First, the Petruchio party arrives with Vincentio, only to find Vincentio, the pedant, already there with Lucentio, Tranio. Vincentio is seen as an impostor, irony alert, and he believes that Tranio has killed his son and taken his place. Only with the arrival of the newly wedded Lucentio and Bianca are the relationships worked out and resolved. All that's left now is the wedding banquet, which takes place in the second scene, the last one of the play. Here we see the two most recently wed women, the widow and Bianca, make shrewish comments to Kate and to the men. Only Kate seems remotely kind or polite. And now we see the graduation of taming school, of which Petruchio is the master. After the wives go off to talk, the three newly married men all bet to see whose wife is the most obedient. They call for their wives. Bianca refuses. So does the widow. Only Kate responds and returns. And then she goes on to call the wives and gives them a 45-line speech in which she seemingly declares and upholds the husband's superiority. Petruchio has won. He has tamed the shrew, and the fairy tale is over. Okay, so that's the play. But now let's go back to the beginning and back to the end of another play. The Taming of the Shrew. That's our play. But there's also a play called The Taming of a Shrew. And while the authorship is in question, what's not is that that play follows the plot line of our play within a play of The Shrew pretty closely. But it also does a better job of completing the Christopher Sly framing device. Now, we don't have a resolution for the practical joke. When we find him again at the end of the play, he's Christopher Sly again, passed out on the street again. The tapster finds him and wakes him and sends him home to his wife, a wife that Sly now professes he will be able to bend to his will as he knows now how to tame a shrew. He doesn't remember his moments as a lord, but he remembers the play as the best dream he's ever had, and it has provided this new philosophy and methodology, one that he intends to use presently. The tapster ends the play saying that he's going to follow Sly home to hear what happens. So we have an opening induction by Shakespeare that few dispute, but it doesn't complete itself nor come to any conclusion. And we have an ending in another play whose authorship is up to debate, to say the very least. Why does the Sly storyline disappear? Does our text come from an incomplete quarto or a bad folio? We may never know. Did Shakespeare tire of it? And if so, why is the opening fragment of a framing device still there? It doesn't make any sense. Now, it's dangerous to attribute intention to anything a writer writes, unless the author in question has left behind some sort of compositional journal, and even then, can we trust those completely? But it is fun to try to make sense of the seemingly nonsensical. Now, personally, I find the play pretty disappointing on a first read, years after having really read it for the first time. But as I learn more about this A Shrew text, and as I begin a second reading, I'm warming up to a theory, one that reconciles the feminist haters of the play, the folks who believe Shakespeare wrote A Shrew, and those bardolaters who believe that he can do no wrong. I am not one of them. He can most certainly do wrong. I just think he may be doing quite right here. Sly watches the history and thinks it's factual. But it's not, far from it. It's over-the-top sexist, perfect for a man wakened to, at least the description of, nearly pornographic paintings, and a wife who hasn't seen him in 15 years. It's ridiculous, but played with a straight face by the actors. I can picture Sly falling asleep in the final scene of the play within a play, maybe even before the final Kate speech, then dumped outside for the closing of the frame story. It's been a wonderful dream for the drunken Sly. And maybe we, as a sober audience, should take Petruchio's Taming of Kate in the same way, as a fever dream of a horny drunk. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries, you've missed out on deeper dives into the subjects we've talked about today, as well as the following. The play's various sources and versions, the use of prose and rhyming in the play, as well as the poetic inconsistencies in the verse. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions, or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or at our Facebook page, though the Facebook page is more for Shakespearean news than daily discussions of our play of the month. And of course, join us again for next week's podcast, when we'll discuss more Taming of the Shrew, as well as the play on film. Been listening to the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for September 13th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.